Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
You're listening to Griefcast with me, Cariad Lloyd. Griefcast is a place to talk, share and laugh about the peculiar human process of death and grief. Each week, I talk to a different person about their experiences of grief and death as we remember someone that they have lost along the way, whether it was a long time ago or you've just joined the club. Welcome to Griefcast.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey Griefsters, I hope you're having an okay week. It's about the fourth time I've tried to record this introduction because I'm very tired and I keep, well, someone in the background was listening and he said I sounded a bit mad, so hopefully I don't sound too mad in this one. Thank you for your amazing comments about this season. I hugely appreciate everyone who's been in touch. I've been quite excited about this season. I think we've had some amazing guests and amazing conversations. If you've been enjoying it, please do rate, review and subscribe. It makes such a huge difference. And if you've done that already, thank you so much. This week, I'm talking to journalist and writer Seamus O'Reilly. Seamus is the author of the very, very funny, I can't really emphasise how funny this book is, even though it is about death, and it is called Did Ye Hear Mammy Died? It is such a brilliant book. We do discuss it on the chat that you're about to hear, but yeah, I know I recommend a lot of books, but this one is a really funny read, even though, as I said, it's about something very sad. Seamus is just the loveliest writer, the way he captures childhood grief and the bizarreness that comes with it. I think if you enjoy Griefcast, you'll definitely enjoy that book. So here is Seamus talking about the grief he experienced when his mum died when he was just five. This is a weird thing to say about a book that does encompass grief, and I feel like maybe I'm the only person who can say it because my show is in the same vein, but it is such a funny book. Like, it is such a brilliant, brilliant funny book. I get sent a lot of books about grief and I don't always approach them happily because it's like, oh, here we go. And I have been just chuckling reading your book so much. So congratulations on
that. Oh, thank you so much. It's definitely intended.
Good, so good.
People have actually said that to me quite a bit, where they're like, oh, I don't know if I'm allowed to say that I enjoyed your book. I was like, you absolutely are supposed to tell me that you enjoyed it.
Yeah.
And I think it gets to something. I mean, the book obviously has got the sad bits in it because that's the material is my mom died when I was very little and everything, and so we'll get into that. But it's also, I absolutely intended it to be a funny book, and I think it speaks to a wider thing about how and why humor is valued, not just in grief but just in culture. I think it's always a little subset. It's always like, you know, the best comedy you have ever seen would never win Best Picture at the Oscars.
You know?
And there's something like almost that the more humour you add to something, either you cheapen it or you separate it away from a sort of art that we give plaudits to. And there's a certain level at which, you know, something like, even in TV, like Succession or Fleabag are excellent, very, very, very funny shows. But it's almost as if they were just slightly funnier, they would just be, oh, great comedy.
Yeah.
But they wouldn't be Emmy winning. They wouldn't be the show. No. They wouldn't be, because there has to be. There's almost this po-facedness or seriousness. And I think I wanted to attack the issue and basically the story of my childhood with the humor, because I think I want to stick up for humor. I want to stick up for the fact that it's, this stuff can be really, really horrible and sad, but it can also be incredibly funny. And through the eyes of a child, which I was when my mum died, I think a lot of that humour is just right there. So it's real.
Yeah, it's real, isn't it? And I just think as well, what I love so much is, if you are a family that deals with things through humour, which my family was exactly the same, then, you know, it's a place of safety when something happens, that someone, you know, you're all heartbroken, you're all sad, and someone will just crack a joke that just cracks everybody. And then you're still sad, but it just gives you those like bubbles of relief where you're able to just, you know, have a moment. My mum always says, if you don't laugh, you'll cry, which, you know, I've had to have a lot of therapy about her attitude to that. But I do think it's sort of, you know, relevant and not relevant. But so, yeah, let's start at the beginning. So obviously you said away, but who are we remembering today?
Today we are remembering Sheila O'Reilly, who was Naoi McGullion, who was my mother, still is my mother, I suppose. It's just a few weeks, 2 weeks ago, it was her 30th anniversary.
Oh my goodness.
Yes.
Famous. Wow.
So as you can tell by my incredibly clear skin and kind child's eyes, I was only a little boy. So I was 3 weeks before my 6th birthday, which also lets you know when my birthday is if you're the present giving type in 8 days. So it was obviously tragically sad. She was only 43. It was breast cancer, and she and my father had 11 kids. So I should be clear that even by the standards of Irish families and very Irish Catholic families in the 70s and 80s, this is a truly gigantic family.
I love what you wrote about that in the book, of like, look, I just want you have a whole like paragraph, I just want to clear up, this isn't just an Irish thing. Irish people thought we were weird, like in our minibus with 11 of us on there, other people, and that amazing, what did you say, of like people used to work out what school year they were in by which O'Reilly was in the year with them.
Oh yeah, and not only that, but I'd said that because I'd heard my brother and a few other people had heard that said to them, but it was a kind of a good story that I'd heard second and third hand. Since writing the book, people have gotten in touch saying, oh yeah, we used to do that, we got a, my brother was a Sinead, my sister was a twins, meaning you were in the same year as the twins in our family.
Oh my God.
So I had all these things which I didn't really want to go digging into in case I turned out that that was maybe kind of a thing that people said, and they've all been confirmed. I've had people come and get in contact and say, oh, you won't remember me, but I got the bus with you guys every year, and I remember the minibus that your dad drove, which I describe, which it was nicknamed obviously the O'Reilly Mobile, with some horrible inevitability. So yeah, we were aware that we were a big family even then, and that it was crazy to have such a big family. In my parents' generation, families that size would have been slightly more common. I mean, my in-laws, my wife's parents, they're both one of 12.
Wow.
So they would have been in the 40s, 50s, 60s.
Yeah, kind of. My granddad was one, he's East End. He was one of 7. But like, I think like 11 and 12 is like, what?
Yeah, I think in my childhood, I would have known a few people who were like 5, 6. And they were considered big families because those are big families. So we were, so that was obviously one strand of my life story. The fact that my mum died, and at 44, my father was widowed and then had to bring up 11 kids. And they were all at different ages. So they also had the kids very quickly. So the 11 kids at the time of my mother's death were between 2 and 17 years old. So all children, no adults yet, and at every single stage. So if you think of every single type of grief you can imagine, just because they're individuals, but also because they're at different ages, different school years. Also the way that someone who is, you know, older and knows that they're about to go off to university, that's hard to parse and to kind of work out. Then there's a 14-year-old who's stuck in the middle, then there's 10-year-olds who just about are kind of making their sense of things in the world, and then there's people like me who are 5, and my little sister and little brother who kind of didn't really know what was going on at all. So it's all of that stuff combined under one roof, where, you know, my dad is also mourning the love of his life, and someone who he's never remarried, and he's never had another relationship. He, you know, he really that was such a big thing for him personally. And it is only in writing the book that I actually interrogated that, because I'm obviously a wonderful person who only thinks about himself. And I thought about it from loads of other angles. I thought about how tough it must have been for him to raise kids, obviously. I thought about how horrible and scary it must have been, you know, traipsing through, you know, life in a minibus with 11 kids. And then, as you know, some of us went off to college and started lives for ourselves elsewhere, you know, 7, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4 kids. Yeah. But like going through checkpoints, because this was during the Troubles in Derry, all that stuff is background noise. But something I hadn't really thought about was his own relationship.
Yeah,
the fact that he saw his wife die over the course of 3 or 4 years, with remissions in between and hope there and thereabouts. And, you know, the fact that he, you know, the universe just collapsed.
Mm.
And the thing I tried to get across in the book is, and I tease my dad a lot and I make fun of my dad and I kind of make him into a cartoon, because he is a cartoon, really. There's so many funny things about him. But I want everybody who reads the book to come away with the idea that after the universe collapsed, he kind of held it up together with his own hands.
Yeah.
He brought it back to life again when everything died. And he did it with such sort of diligence and hard work and without complaining that we never had the opportunity to give him credit. So,
I mean, it's extraordinary. It really is. Like you said, it is extraordinary, because it is an unusual amount of children. And you know, my dad died when he was 44, and it's a really young age, you know. And especially, you know, as you get to the age where you start approaching it, and you think, oh my God, because I maybe same as you, I don't know what you had, but I remember when I was 15, I thought my dad was old, because I was like, 44
yeah,
is old.
Of course.
Like, so when he died, I was like, well, old people do die. So, and then as I've got older, I've had completely, again, like you said, you refigure everything, don't you? You think, oh, actually, I was quite young. But for your mum to die at 43 is so young. And then to have to hold together 11 people. I mean, 11 people, you know, even if he was like a boss of a company with 11 people and like he had to hold them together, that would be a big job. You'd be like, wow, gosh, well, that's really hard. 11 kids.
There was also the multipliers. So basically, at certain times, things were easier or less easy. I mean, from 1990 to 2000, I believe it was, he had 6 of his 7 daughters were teenagers at once.
I mean, no.
What on earth? Like, I mean, and things, as I say in the book, like, I can't imagine what that was like. And I was literally there.
Oh my God.
Like, and I do remember, like, we lived in a bungalow in the countryside. It had loads of rooms. It was like basically an old farmhouse. Very far from anywhere else. We were right on the border with the Republic of Ireland. And we didn't have, like, you know, en suites for everybody or anything.
Yeah.
So some mornings you just literally go out and do a wee in the field. Or, you know, if you could, like, Glastonbury rules, just because.
How else are you going to get anything done? Yeah.
Yeah, like every time you picked up the phone, there was always some sort of conversation going on.
Oh my God.
I just, like, there was slamming of doors and all these kinds of things that I couldn't quite understand. So, like, I would, and at the time my dad was 50. This is a 50-year-old rural Northern Irish man who is, you know, at least helping to guide or shepherd his teenage daughters through adolescence, is so far beyond the means or the experience of any of my friends' parents.
Yeah.
But specifically their dads. And I think I tried to get across that part of my dad's genius was in being able to welcoming us talking about our emotions in a way that was very, very natural and very gentle. It was partly inspired by his own faith. He was very Catholic, but also very, very committed to a sort of a folk Catholicism, you know? He liked the masses that had the guitars, basically, is what I'm trying to say. Those, you kind of can have a picture in your idea of what that might be like. And we used to go to cross-community stuff with, you know, Catholics and Protestants kind of worshipping together and stuff. I do not have the faith my father did, but I totally love those kind of tenets of togetherness and family and work and love being work, and part of that work being putting yourself in the awkward position of listening to people when they're sad. And he would sit and he would listen and he would say, well, I feel sad sometimes. I don't know, these kind of like Sesame Street platitudes, but they were so bananas removed from anything that my friends' dads
would
have had even the vocabulary to say, even if they'd, I'm sure they probably wanted at times to say these things. And particularly in Northern Ireland, well, Ireland North and South, but particularly in Derry, you know, it's now thankfully much more in vogue for people to talk about feelings and those kinds of things. But like, we're still so far away, so far away from it being normalised to that point. I mean, there's still, the dads my age in Derry, I don't know if they can. I mean, I, on the other hand, have the opposite problem where I genuinely feel like I give my son more direct praise every single day than I ever received in my life. I'm like, am I going to raise a psychopath? Like, I don't know. I don't know what the answer is. I don't know how to hold the balance.
Because you're used to being, you know, an 11th of something.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a very different experience to, like, you know.
Just, absolutely.
He's got one-on-one. Like, that's completely different. But yeah, your dad sounds incredible. And I think, like you said, there's a lot of factors that obviously came together. Like you said, his faith, being an extremely practical person who was good at, like, fixing things. I'm sure that was unbelievably helpful as you drive across Europe in a minivan. Like, and like, that's the bit that stuck with me recently. Like, I thought that was a really nice bit. So you all get in this van and you all drive to see your mum's sister in Spain. And the car, you know, the door falls off. There's a hole in the van. And it's not until he gets to Spain that, you know, you realise, oh, that's probably where he starts being allowed to grieve. Because you're right, like, the chaos of children. And I've had a lot of listeners say this to me. You know, it postpones grief. And they now call it delayed grief, the sort of the technical term for it. Like, if you have to look after an ailing parent, or you have to sell the house, or you have to look after 11 children, you can't grieve in the normal way. You can't go, okay, here's all my feelings, let's face them.
No, and I think it's kind of a subset of that other thing that happens in Irish culture, which is the wake. And the wake is almost like the sticking plaster on the dam of grief that happens, because for 2 days, maybe 3 days after the person dies, for the funeral and the wake and the sort of waking the body, there's a period of hyper socialization where there's hundreds of people sometimes. In our case, there was very hundreds and hundreds of people coming and going in the house, saying, you know, giving their wishes, and having, we all had to be fed and given tea. And I've never had to arrange or even be part of a group of people who've had to arrange anything for a funeral or a wake in my adult life, thankfully, touch wood. But I can kind of imagine in my head that that'd be the last thing I'd ever want to do. I mean, personally, God, I'd be like, no, I want to climb into a hole in the ground and I want to just block everything out. And I just want to never think about it. Are you telling me I have to have 400 people traipsing through my house?
And feed them all and give them all tea and make, and everyone's got
make
chairs.
Pyramids of sandwiches. I mean, that's another thing, by the way. A lot of things in Father Ted that people who are not from Ireland thought were, like, absurd.
Yeah.
Or not, they're like kitchen sink, like the pyramid of sandwiches and the people offering you tea. Like, that's like 5% more extreme than it actually is in real life. Like, there was literally like ice sculpture sized pyramids of vol-au-vents. And do you like my pronunciation of that?
I did very nice, yeah.
And sandwiches. So in the book I say that maybe that's what that's for. It's like, yes, you can absolutely grieve and tear yourself apart, but how about you make 600 cups of tea first and then come back to me? So it's like you were saying. And while writing the book, I then had that revelation that that's exactly what planning that trip was. My dad's a very methodical guy. He's an engineer by, retired engineer by trade. So he's a practical man. You know, he built his first house literally from scratch, literally from plans that he himself had drawn.
Oh my God.
He studied architecture in university. He was part of the first basic generation of Northern Irish Catholics who were able to get third level education. So he was part of that whole crew who were like, yeah, I'll do it myself. And that is his buzz. You know, he would do things himself. And part of that was he'd become obsessed with, like, planning, say, a trip to Spain to see my Auntie Aileen. And, you know, it meant getting out the maps and the pencil and making sure he had the right line. And, okay, we're going to bring this, we're going to bring that. And then we had our minibus, obviously, but on the way there, we're going to have to sleep. So we had a 26-foot caravan. So with the minibus and the caravan together, it's like a 50-foot long conveyance, which had to go around. I don't know if you've ever driven in the Pyrenees.
Yes, it's like wiggly, wiggly roads.
Like,
tiny.
When you see cyclists doing it, you're like, oh my God, this is this is death defying. We were doing it in like basically like it was like center point driving down the
why Pyrenees. I just like when I read that I was like surely there was a better road to go on, but I was like I guess not, you gotta go from England to France to Spain, like yeah. Go
so we went from Derry to Plymouth I think, and then France and whatever way it was, but my dad loves all that stuff. My dad loves planning and I realise I do too. I loved, even when I was writing the book, I was like, loved getting all my recordings and alphabetising them and everything. Part of that was absolutely procrastination. I'm sure that's common to loads of writers or people who should be coming up with it.
I think it's definitely, you can see how with grief, it's a safe place, isn't it? Because you've lost control. Something has come into your world, taken someone, and you had no say in the matter. And but what you can do is you can plan a holiday and you can, you know, and like in a way it's so interesting, isn't it? Because that's exactly what you as 11 kids needed, was someone to just be like, I'm not going to crawl into a hole. I'm not going to, you know, put the telly on and not speak to anyone. I am going to like plan this and keep us all on track. And I guess, I mean, you know, he probably, there's a sense in the book of you're like, well, you know, that he's very kind of like, well, that's what I did. And it's like, but he didn't have to. He could have collapsed. He could have. And he obviously, the strength in him to not.
Well, not only that, I mean, the thing he's actually very remarkably kind of clear-eyed about is that if he had collapsed, nobody would have judged him.
Yeah.
You know, he said at one time to me, and I didn't put this in the book because I didn't want it to seem like it was referencing a bigger thing than it was. But he was like, one time, about 2 months afterwards, he was having, my dad's not a drinker really at all. My mum never drank in her life. She was a pioneer, kind of a swore off alcohol for Catholic reasons. And my dad wasn't a big drinker, but he'd have the odd glass of wine, the odd beer. Like maybe at like Christmas or something, or maybe with his Sunday dinner, he might have a glass of wine. And he was at a thing and he was having a glass of wine. And someone made some comment about, oh, jeez, you know, it's just so good to see you, Joel. Good to see you're having something to drink. That's nice. Some little comment or something.
Yeah.
And he was like, okay, I'm not drinking. Not going to do that in public. That's a thing that people know. That's a thing that people could make a thing about. And when he said that, I was like, I can totally imagine that being your response. Because you don't want to give them or yourself that an out.
Yeah,
or some sort of a thing which anybody could ever say, oh, that's Jesus. Well, wouldn't you be driven to drink or whatever?
Yeah.
And especially, I mean, it speaks a lot into, I think, rural Ireland as well, and its attitudes to drink is its whole other issue. But it was funny to me that it also spoke to the fact that he was slightly embarrassed by the fact that this was such a story. There is nobody who knew, you know, 10 parsons over who hadn't at least heard about that family with 11 kids that the mum died.
Yeah.
And it's just the dad there looking after them. And sure, Jesus, I saw him having a drink or something like that. You know?
Yeah,
that's what he feared. And we'd have people who we didn't know particularly well who would pop in. And there was, just within their well-meaning, the slight whiff of rubbernecking. There was it becoming something where, like in school, I went to new schools, like in my secondary school, and someone told like one of those jokes like, oh, your ma's so fat, she's, you know, blah, blah, blah. Which could never offend me because I really, really, really like jokes. And also, I get that it's a construct. Even at 11 years old, they would never make me upset. Even if you did it deliberately, it wouldn't make me upset. Be like, but what do you mean? And even I hadn't spoken to any of them about the fact that my mum died, but they all knew.
Yeah.
And they all went, oh, God, oh, that's so lousy. And then the guy was like, he remembered it. He was like, oh, my God. And like that was even worse. I was having to stage manage other people's upset. Yeah,
it's interesting, and I think there's definitely an element which maybe's changed, maybe hasn't, of like when the mum goes of a family with a lot of children. I think, you know, as in like how will the dad cope, and like you said, that kind of rubbernecky. I had a friend at primary school whose mum passed away of breast cancer actually, and again there was three of them, and there was definitely that like, oh, how will he cope? And then he was amazing, and there was definitely like not a surprise, but like he's actually doing very well, you know, like even though he's a man, he's actually doing very well with the children. Because, and I don't, you know, no one sort of questioned whether my mum would cope with her kids. It was like, well, yeah, the mum's still alive. It was more like, how will you survive? Because the man has gone. But it was never like looking after the children. It's this innate sense of a man with 11 children. What will he do? So of course he had like such a... And like you said, no one would have judged him for having a drink. Like, Jesus.
Like, yeah. I think it's weird though, because as well, there's two things. One is... my dad hated that kind of talk about him, because he hated the thought that we were being pitied, because also he felt like it was literally his job, and it was literally the thing which he dedicated his life to was family, and before my mum died. So to him it was, maybe there was a slight grain of offence in there, like you're saying. It's like, why would it be so surprising to you that I love my children?
Yeah.
But two, I have to say, having had that example my entire life and not really having very many memories at all of mothering or having a mother, it has solidified an awful lot of very, very, very strong feelings about parenting in me now that I have my own son. I have very little patience for the genre of dad bants. About... you know, expressly hating having to do the work of parenting.
As if because, it's just like, oh my God, that awful thing, my child.
For 3 years, I have written a column where, of course, I have strayed into that territory about parenting, because some of that stuff is very funny.
Yeah.
But there's a point where it kind of shifts over, you know, and you hear certain, particularly men, say, almost act as if it's an imposition that they have to raise their children. I mean, the fact that, for example, someone like Jacob Rees-Mogg can go on the radio and say that he's never changed a nappy.
Oh, I know.
I wanted to burn him to the ground. I wanted to burn him to the ground like the guy that he is, like the horrible tweed nonsense scarecrow man that he is. Because that to me is repulsive. It's a repulsive idea, and it's a repulsive act. It's like psychopathic uncaringness. I'm just refusing to roll up your sleeves. Do the work.
We still, it's funny, so yeah, I have two kids, not husbands, and that would be too much work. And I work a lot, and we share the parenting a lot, and yeah, my husband says the same thing of like, the way he is praised for being in a playground and looking after a kid, like, and he's like, they're mine, but they're like, oh, he's so good, isn't he? He is good because he goes to the playground. It is good that he does that. And you're like, literally no one fucking says well done to me when I do this.
Yeah,
no one
2 weeks
cares.
Ago,
like, yeah,
2 weeks ago at my mum's, I went back for my mum's anniversary, and I took my son by myself. It was the first time we ever flown together by ourselves. It was a laugh. It was slightly stressful, but it was fun. But on the flight the whole way, I was fawned over, and I literally just wrote about this for the Observer. Like, I'm not saying the bar is low.
But I was literally
praised for like wiping his nose.
Yeah.
There was one beside us who just thought it was absolutely adorable that I wasn't, I don't know, beating him over the head with a lead pipe or something.
And that's in our generation where it is a bit more usual for men to be involved. But you said your dad's generation, like, you know, my mum praises my husband a lot. Oh, he's so good, he's so good. And I have argued, he's not good, he's just doing his job. And she always says, well, I mean, I could never have left your dad with you. And you're like, literally, you could have left. She's like, oh, no, wouldn't be safe. Like, and you're like, so if your dad to have taken that mantle on, and as you said, for that to be, and to be emotional, and to allow you guys to grieve. So, like, so what happened when you would obviously, of course, get upset? He would allow your mum's memory to be kept alive then, I guess, and to talk about it.
Yeah, absolutely. My mum and dad, I mean, I should probably actually preface this by telling a little bit more about my mum, because obviously the book obviously talks about the parent that I know the best, despite its name. But I should say my mum was a very... almost preternaturally empathetic person. She was a truly beautiful, wonderful person. And my dad would probably say that most of his parenting style, I don't think his skills or his talents, I think those are all his own, but his style was very much informed by her style. There is an unbelievable level of kindness, a sort of radical kindness to my mother. So much so that she was in Derry for 6 years. and there was 1,000 people at the funeral. Wow. She had 11 kids. She taught French and Irish in school, and she was undergoing cancer treatment. And 6 months before she died, she decided she was going to learn German because my brother Shane and Sinead, they had a language trip, and one of the teachers dropped out. And as a language teacher, she thought she would go. She doesn't speak German. I will learn GCSE German in 1 year, which she did with 11 kids and a full-time job and undergoing cancer treatment.
Sheila would not approve of me saying things like that.
Oh my God. Yeah, so, I mean, also they had 11 kids, but they also fostered 6 or 7 kids. She was that person, though.
Oh, my goodness.
And the thing about that is, obviously, what happens is you get told all these beautiful, wonderful stories. Like, people would stop me on the street. I probably reminded them of one of my brothers and sisters that they did know, because I'm at the younger end. They say, "Are you Sheila's boy?" And they would grab me by the cheeks and say, "You don't know me, but she did such a..." And it would be some kindness, you know. She'd gone and visited someone in a hospice, or she'd offered something for someone. She was just that person. She really was. And it meant that whenever I was growing up, there's a beautiful portrait of her that's up in our sitting room still to this day. And she looks gorgeous in the sort of 80s, sort of like a little blazer. And it's very kind of a professional sort of headshot looking picture. And so that's how I think of her, really, because I saw the picture every single day. And I'd occupied the same place in the home and kind of in my mental state as like the Virgin Mary picture that we would have elsewhere, or the Sacred Heart, or, you know, it was a devotional icon almost.
Yeah.
And so growing up, I found it very hard to parse those things. She was the saintly woman who was this incredible person about whom I didn't really know very much. So I gravitated towards the people at those get-togethers and memorials, and we had a mass for my mum every year. I gravitated towards her friends who would tell me stuff that wasn't nice about her. I would gravitate to ones who would, you know, say like the blasphemous things, like she couldn't tell a joke to save her life. Or if you wanted her to write a story, it would be like the man on the field walked in the, you know, she's just, you know, like really just assassinating her, you know.
That
it added so much to it. It adds so much to the roundness of a picture, because I think for people who lose someone before they really got a chance to know them, that's life raft.
Well, you need the whole picture, don't you? You need the whole human. And it's interesting to me because often I speak to people who, you know, were a child when their parent died, and they'll say, oh, you know, everyone kind of like, oh, they were so wonderful. But often they're saying that out of politeness because someone's died. But it's interesting because it sounds like your mum really was almost saintly. So you're not just dealing with like people being polite because she died young and she had 11 kids, so they would say nice things. You're dealing with the fact that she was genuinely a really helpful, kind person. But as you said, that doesn't, you, when you grow up, you have to form, as you would have done, if she had been around, you would have, you know, got to know her as a teenager and adult, and maybe had a row one time, and they would have become a fully fleshed person. And I think it can be hard if you're not in that club, that niche of the club, to understand why you need other details, because like you said, they're so vague, aren't they? You've only got like this one aspect of them, like you and them, you as a 5-year-old, them as an adult, and you want the other bits that you didn't get.
Yeah, I mean, I was doing an event with Dr. Julia Samuels. Isn't she just wonderful?
Oh, she's amazing.
I did the Dare Parents Club thing for the Good Grief Festival.
Yeah.
And Safraz Mansour was there, and he'd said exactly the opposite thing, which was that, and I don't want to sort of steal his memory. I don't want to get the story wrong, but it was something like that. After his father had died, his mother's tellings of his father was that he was this unbelievable saint, and there was maybe a disconnect for him, and like, oh well, you know, he might not have been that perfect, and we bonded over that same thing because he could remember, you know, all the faults and failings and everything else, whereas I've got the opposite thing where I have to go and outsource it. I have to get it from, you know, luckily the 10 external hard drives that I have that I'm related to, but also from my father. I mean, you mentioned like how my father would give us space and stuff. Well, literally we would sit around sometimes. They were kind of slightly mortifying little family meetings that were kind of intermittent, because the mortification was very real. And bear in mind that as much as I might have been into it because I was eight, you know, the 15 and 16 year olds were like, well, this is the what is thing. This what is this Brady Bunch nonsense, what is that? Because we were a lot more sarcastic and ironic and sardonic than our parents, who were my dad still is extremely like he's not necessarily in the same current of humour as I am. I can make him laugh.
Yeah.
And I've got to read him the book, most of the book, before it was published, and he laughed a lot. But there were some parts of which he could never find funny because it's just not his style of humour. His style of humour is Northern Irish radio DJs making jokes about politics. But he, you know, in those meetings, and also just if I went one-to-one, he would speak with a sort of this luxurious softness in his voice. He had a very, very calming voice. Still does. And he hates it when I do this impression because he says it's not very accurate. But it actually is extremely accurate. And so it's very honey-tipped. And he adds this register that he sips into. Because, I mean, sometimes, a lot of time, he's just, you know, he's annoyed because someone hasn't got the grass or whatever else. But he slips into this register, which is like sort of God Daddy, you know? Mm. It's like, I address him as Daddy at all times because it is his name. In the Northern Irish kind of colloquial sense, not in a sort of posh sense. So I'm like, Daddy, not feeling great. Or Daddy, miss Mummy, or whatever. And I remember doing that once or twice. And I remember being in the room when other people had. And he would just, you know, embrace us and talk to us about it. And it was just more the fact that you felt like it wasn't something that you were doing that was sucking all the air out of the room and that you'd never do again, even if someone's nice to you. Because that's another thing about grief, is that I always, and I'm sure I fail at this loads of times, when someone has been through something and they're talking to me about it, I always try and marshal my body language and my responses so that even if I'm there and I'm present and I'm listening to it, that's not enough. They have to know that I am absolutely engaged and this is not a downer for me.
Yes.
To the point that they should never bring this up again, because we know what active listening looks like. And we also know what people are like, oh yeah, that sounds really sad. Yeah. Have you talked? Do you want to? Yeah. Okay. You know, those kinds of, because sometimes you don't want to talk about this stuff with the person who has gone through it.
Yeah.
But you have to man up and do it. And you have to, depending on the relationship you have with this person, if it's someone at a bus stop, I mean, maybe you might. I mean, and everyone knows.
Yeah, there's limits. But that sounds amazing that he allowed that space. And I think that's, it's interesting, isn't it? Because there were so many of you, there's lots of opportunities, like you said, for others to bring it up. And then for the, as you describe in the book, the wee ones, the, you know, the younger gang, to watch. And that's what you do a lot as a kid. And I mean, I had this a lot because my brother was 19 when he died, so I would kind of like, if he got upset and my mum and him would then talk about it, I'd be sat there like watching fucking David Attenborough. I'd be like, oh okay, okay, so it's okay to talk about it and mum doesn't get cross and we're all crying, but that's okay. And that definitely, as you said, that you just want, you want that feeling to be like, the door is open, the door is open. Doesn't mean you have to talk, doesn't mean you're forced to talk, but if you ever need to, you, when you're at your lowest grief moment, you want to know, I could talk about it. So for your dad to have that family meeting, or in, and it's that, it's a classic teenage thing. My dad used to make us have family meetings and we would rip him apart for it.
Did you actually? You had family meetings?
Yeah, we had family meetings.
Oh my God.
My parents are very hippie, kind of into like Californian self-help type things. And we used to have family meetings on Sunday to plan the week and set our goals.
Oh, and my goodness, yep. That's just amazing.
and it was mortifying, but there was always a part of me that was like glad. But it's like my deal was like, I'm not going to tell you I'm glad. I'm a fucking teenager. You have to deal with my sarcasm, my face, my body language telling you you're a dickhead. But I want you to do it because it's not my job to be the person that instigates this. I'm just here to be present. And I think that's really, it's a strong thing you have. And you know this from being a parent. You have to sometimes do things on a limb that the child is like, this is rubbish. And you're somewhere and you have to be like, no, I think this is a good thing that they're allowed to say is rubbish, that like, but I think I should still do it. And to do that as well as hold his own grief. Like, I can't imagine having like 11 kids coming up and at different points grieving in front of you. That must have been just And his heart must have been breaking every time, because obviously he deeply misses her, and you deeply miss her, or, you know, which one he was talking to. So to allow, to not shut that down, I guess, is my the point I'm slowly making, is a very, takes a lot of strength to not just go, you know what, I actually can't deal with 11 of you crying.
Yeah, or even just the fact that, you know, I knew from experience of my other friends when I go to other houses, and I'd see how they talk to their parents, and how, and there wasn't that sort of easy empathy. There wasn't the sort of, I mean, my friends, my teenage friends would have been horrified to, if they saw it, were a fly on the wall and saw that, you know, even when I was 14 or 15, when my dad came home, we would rush and give him a big hug. Some part of that is obviously, you know, once bitten, twice shy. We know how fragile these things are.
Yeah.
And also there's that other thing, which is buried back in the deep in the back of your brain, is this could happen again. Yeah. That could be him gone, you know?
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome back to Griefcast with Carrie Adloyd.
I mean, I really love that thing you said before about, you know, you kind of, you arrive at the party early, you lay out the twiglets. and I really love that as a metaphor, because I do feel like, obviously, this is a club that no one wants to be a member of, which every single person who has or will ever live will experience what I experienced and what you experienced. But it's just at completely different times.
Yeah.
So to some extent, it's an infinite amount of ways that it can happen. But I will say that I think that so many of the circumstances of my childhood, which seem from the outside a sad story, were really saved from being a sad story because of a lot of its constituent parts. The fact that I had 10 brothers and sisters, but we all loved each other, that was that's 10 life rafts right there.
Yeah.
The fact that it was my dad, you know, he was left to look after us, but not left to look after us, like, it's like he was dropped from space as the perfect man who could ever do this job. My father, very movingly, he said he wasn't scared after the last time he talked to my mum, and she said she wasn't scared, and she said, "I'm not scared, I know you can do it." And like, obviously I am bawling my eyes out when I'm hearing this.
I could probably,
and my dad saying this to me, relating her, not her last words, it was, that was, you know, wasn't the last conversation they had, but it was, he was terrified because he was losing her and because of everything else, and she just looked at her with this, you know, the infinite kindness of it, can you imagine, where she must be going through so much, and then she says, "I'm not scared," you know, and like, that really affected me, and I was like, Christ, I mean, I don't know if I could put that in the book, because I'd need like two or three jokes either side of it just to get just to get my life back. I mean, I'm welling up now just thinking about it, because that kind of load to bear, and I'm so, so lucky. And my childhood, the reason why so much of the stuff for the book is, you know, zips along and is funny and has a lot of absurdity and is meant to do that, is because I had just such an umbrella over me, with, you know, with circumstance and with the active will of my family, and particularly my father, that, you know, what should have been the death of the universe was somehow, you know, allowed to keep on trucking and to prosper, you know?
Yeah, I mean, that is an incredible thing to say. That is an incredible, I'm welling up, because that's the thing. I guess if you really, you know, as both of us understand the Dead Parent Club, you know how precious the you know, because we know there's the point where the person dies and everything afterwards is the completely different, you know, it's like AD, BC, you know, like the world changed. And to give a gift like that to your dad is just so kind, because every time he doubts himself, he's going to be like, she didn't. She knew, like, she had faith. She believed in me. And that's going to give you so much strength. And just to, that's, and not to say she did it, to, you know, I'm going to say this thing to him because that's going to help. But like, just, it's just a really beautiful, it says a lot about their love and their relationship and yeah. how much they adored you all. And it's funny, isn't it? I wonder if you can relate to this. I did a thing ages ago and, it was like a gig where everyone was like talking about weird experiences, and this guy stood up, he'd nearly died, and you know, obviously it was very sad, he'd nearly died, but the way he sort of framed it was like, and I thought of my child and I would never see my child, you know, do her GCSEs or get married, and I thought, what could, you know, what kind of life would I have given this person? And I was sat next to him like, I mean, my life, like she would have had my life and I'm okay. And there's that thing of like, you're not saying you're glad it happened, but they're like, I guess to just be thankful for the things that mean you're okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it obviously is a terrible, terrible thing that happens, but sometimes people treat it like, oh God, like, how did you survive? And you're like, well, it's because of people who love me and me.
Yeah,
and there's, my mum. Like,
and there's a sort of a queasiness, I think, that other people have, which I've kind of been inoculated against, in seeing all the things which have happened in my life since, which I can pretty much, I can pretty much confirm that they wouldn't have been as good, you yeah. know, if we hadn't suffered this horrible shock. And that's obviously not the same thing as saying it's a good thing that my mum died.
No.
But it's like, huh, well, I have a really powerfully close relationship with my family, and I have a unbelievably loving relationship with my dad.
Mm.
And it's a very funny, teasing relationship with him. It's very close and, you know, piss-takey. But there's a, like, it's a bright, burning fire of love that I have for him, which I almost have to, it almost scares me when I think about it too much. So I have to make fun of the fact that he
yeah.
had never heard of a high five, or until very recently, he once at a dinner table said, slap my hand high up in the air. This is, you know, this is the kind of guy, he's younger than like Paul McCartney or Mick Jagger, but he's like a 400-year-old man sometimes.
Yeah.
And he's a fuddy-duddy and he's silly about some of the things that he says and does and whatever. He believes that he can speak to dogs and that they speak back.
But like you said, it's because that love is so strong, because you know what it's like to lose someone, you have to add humour into it. Because if you woke up every day and acknowledged what that person had done for you, how much you adored them, it would be a bit awkward. So you have to... Yeah, you really have to kind of make jokes about it. And I can relate to a lot. You know, every time me and my mum and my brother have had one of our, you know, you've had a bit where everyone's had a cry and, you know, it's, you're having a hug and everyone's having a moment. And then it's like some joke just comes in instantly, because it's like, well, it's, we can't stand here telling how much we love each other forever, can we? It's a bit awkward.
That would be weird. That's
yeah.
Like, and that's the part my dad said as well afterwards. Like, because the joke, there's loads of jokes at his expense. You know, I call him God's one perfect miser, because he used to hold up. You know, I mean, I had all the same teenage things with my dad that everybody has with yeah. their dads. Like, he was stroppy. He was inconsiderate sometimes. He was, you know, he wouldn't. He could not pass over a saving or a deal. He at one time, he would buy like 1,000, you know, pack everything, because, you know, big family, but he would buy the cheapest things. Like, no part of me was realizing he was bringing up 11 kids on a single
I know
night.
You wrote about that in the book, about like him like arguing over £2 or something, and I was like, 11 kids, that matters, doesn't it?
Of
like,
course it does. And it's so, I mean, I do write the book as much as possible from the point of view of the person that age,
which hopefully
comes across, like, you know, it's zipping along, because I'm trying to capture the fact that I was so self-absorbed because I'm a child, and
yeah.
you know, and then at certain points I'm a little bit older, like 10 or 11 or whatever, but like those kinds of stories, they can only really be told and made fun of whenever you're thinking about the fact that I'm a 13-year-old boy standing waiting for my dad to cease holding up an entire shop with 1,000 toilet rolls because he's not making £2 saving. If we flipped it around and I'm telling the story from the point of view of a guy who's exhausted, who spent now 10 years looking after 11 kids all by himself and is just trying to be have a deal honoured, and who has no compunction about standing there and holding everyone up. Let them be held up. Let them be held up. Yeah. Okay? He's like, he's made of steel. You know, he's like, that's also funny. So I tried to get that in afterwards, you know, have my cake and eat it. But it wasn't like he was this kind of worshipful god that we just thought was amazing.
No, and I think that's, but again, important to highlight, isn't it? It's not like you have this, again, like a saint. You can't be saintly with people who are still there. Because the day-to-day, of course people get annoyed and they say the wrong thing or you snap or you're tired. So, you know, their position on the pedestal is rocky. But when you've lost a parent at a young age, you like you said, it's like, I think if you haven't and you're a teenager, you're like, oh, fuck them, I hate them. And you're like, oh, fuck them, but I hope they don't die and I know that I'm really lucky to have them. There's just this, like, extra level to everything because, yeah, you know what it looks like when they're not there. And you know, like, you know that, yes, they're annoying, but it's the you know what forever means. You know what dead really means, you know. And yeah, it's, I think you wrote about this book, like you said, it's not, yeah, you did, which I thought was really interesting. Like, it's not when people make, you know, accidentally make jokes about your mum jokes or something. It's when people take the parents for granted. That's what hurts you as a parent, as a someone in the young parent grieving.
Yeah,
group.
It was like it was like watching someone burn a 20 quid note in front
of
you. Whenever they would say, "I hate my mum. Yeah. She won't give me money to go out this weekend," and like I would never say anything because, can you imagine that conversation? Excuse me. Do you know what I would give to have a mother? You know, it's a ridiculous thing to say.
Yeah, and they wouldn't understand. That's the other thing when you're young.
No, it
sounds
like
dealing with people who don't, like, even if you did say anything, they'd just look at you like, oh, what? And you're like, there's no point. You just sort of have it in your head, don't you?
And to some extent, I kind of would agree with them. It's sort of emotional terrorism.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, how the hell are you going to have that conversation?
Yeah.
And with a room full of like 10 people who've no idea what they have,
yeah.
And it's not my job to teach them, and it's more just my job to just, okay, just blank out of this, because I'm not going to take on the labour at 15 of trying to explain this to people.
And also, I've got better as I got older. I used to really find it difficult when people like moaned about dads. I remember I had a friend who was like, oh, he's always calling me. What does he want? And I was like, oh my God. And I've got better at going, you know what? People have different relationships and people are different. And actually, maybe with their dad, that is irritating. Like, but because you're in that thing of like, you do, you know, just to have a dad is exciting for me. You know, it's just because, yeah, you just know too early. How has it been with the age gap? Because as in like, so you were 5 when your mum died, and then obviously the ones who were teenagers have a completely different memory of her. You said they're like hard drives, but like, have you then found yourself getting older and wanting to like, oh hey, can you tell me this, can you tell me this, and are they okay talking about it?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that's been incredible just specifically about writing the book is that I've had the opportunity to, because I'm writing a book, it's like I've got a little hat on with the press thing. And we set up a WhatsApp group called Best Face Forward, which is an in-joke in the book. If you buy the book, you'll get the joke. And I just used it, like, I mercilessly used it. It was just saying, hey, does anyone remember this time we went to Westport in Mayo and Mammy, she stung her lip or something with a bee, with a can of lilt? And then there's 200 replies saying it wasn't a can of lilt, it was actually a can of fun, you know. Because this is how you get the stuff out of them.
Yeah.
You could literally ask anything, and I've said this before, but you kind of hope or presume that it's going to be like, you know, the Bourne movies, there's 10 people on satellites, you know, all looking at all the footage, and you get a perfect idea of this terrorist event or something. But actually, it's like getting 10 cats to pose for a photo.
Yeah.
No one remembers. So, like, the name of the book is Did You Hear Mammy Died? And that's based on the story that I, at the wake, age 5, didn't understand enough about death to know that you shouldn't greet everybody that comes in with the cheery refrain, Did you hear Mammy died? So I don't remember that happening.
Yeah.
I was too young, and thankfully my brain just said, no, we can delete that one for you.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, 10 external hard drives. And so they all remember, but half of them remember it, half of them don't. Half of them remember it slightly differently, that it was actually way worse and I was there for like 10 minutes. And others were like, no, you just kind of said it to one person. I just, you know, it's kind of been blown into this thing. I don't know who to believe. I went with the funniest version.
Yeah.
And I had to do that a lot. But the amazing thing to me is, even though we are quite close, and even though we did definitely, as kids, talk about this stuff a bit, for writing the book, one of the best things has been, I could ring, you know, my sister Maeve at 4 p.m. on a random Tuesday and say, what was Mummy's wake like? Now, I would never have had that forthrightness.
Permission
beyond permission. It was like a certificate from the UN. It was like, it was genuinely like, I was like a embedded reporter in my own family. Whereas even though we were, by the standards of these kinds of things, we were very open, talking about our feelings, you know, but we still weren't always in the mood. Or if you were in the mood, you'd talk about the same old stuff, or you'd gravitate towards the funny stories, which is stuff like me going around traumatizing people at the wake by saying, did you hear Mummy died? Or, you know, weird things like, you know, more the funny stories, that was a bit of a release valve. Whereas I was like, literally, how many priests were there at the wake? And then what happened here? My brother Shane told me that my sister Dervla cried so much that her shoe fell off. And I was like, that is such an amazing image. That is immediately going into the book.
Yeah.
My sister, she cried so much her shoe fell off.
Wow.
I'm trying to imagine that. What a wonderful cause and effect. And she had to be taken out and sedated. And I don't know if this is, but there was a GP was there.
Wow.
Was a very close family friend, and he, I don't know if that meant like injecting her or something, I don't know, but that's what he remembers. And he would have been 13 probably.
Oh yeah,
maybe 13, maybe 12. And he told me he remembered going in and like one of our teachers in school came up to him and said, well, you know, I know what this is like, my mother died this year as well. And he was like, you're like 500 years old. What are you talking about? This isn't the same at all. Like, I'm 12 and I know that this is tragic. This is way sadder.
Yeah.
Like, I'm like top tier Premier League. This is tragic.
Yeah. I mean, I get him trying to like build a bridge, but unless you're in the like, if he'd said my mum died when I was 12, you'd be like, oh, okay, you know what it's like to be 12. But if you're not, it's when people just say such weird things, don't you? And you're like, it's okay. You don't have to find a link. You don't have to find a link.
You have to forgive because people are so awkward and they're so nervous. Yeah. And I'm extremely generous with people who say the wrong thing, because it's so hard to navigate this. And I find it so hard to navigate.
It is.
And I feel like you only have to be kind to people who are just trying. And even if they fail, it's normally a funny story.
Give them
all the slack in the world. And if they're a very close friend, you can tease them about it for the rest of their life.
And you said in the book as well that writing had brought back memories that you had lost. Like, so how was it in terms of writing a book and then, you know, having, I've just finished writing my book, which is more about just like grief, but obviously there's been lots of stuff I've had to write about my dad, and I found it a kind of strange process to have to sort of have them with you again after many years of not having them. Like, how did you find it?
I found it lovely for the most part, particularly the chapters where I was actually talking more about my mum specifically, because really most of the book is about grief more generally and how it affected me. Me, the most important, the main character of reality.
Yeah.
Me. But there are chapters then which are more specifically just about my mum. I've got letters that she wrote to my her friend Patricia, which are just incredibly, just mundane letters most of the time. They're not like particularly sort of awe-inspiring, amazing. It's not like Lincoln's, you know, addresses that are kept in the Library of Congress or something. But there's so much heart and beauty in them, and there's so much, the fact that they're handwritten, you know, that makes a difference. And that sat with me. And recalling memories that I had of her. So there's the chapter where I talk about the five memories that I began the book with. And spoiler alert, I when writing the book, I uncovered three more.
It's amazing, isn't it? It's amazing what you can, if you really open that room and you just dig around for a long time. And I think you have to do it for a while. Like, I had it with my book of like, it didn't happen straight away, but it was like my brain was like, oh, you really want to go? Oh, okay, there's some other stuff at the back. I thought you were visiting.
Like, absolutely like that. It was really like that. It was a whole draft of the book and then the whole second, third.
Yeah,
there are a lot of drafts of this book. And in that strange way of memory, they weren't they didn't come like bolt from the blue brand new. It was like, oh, there's that one as well. It was like, it was literally like you're looking for your glasses and they're literally right in front of you. And you're like, oh, yeah, of course, there's that one too. But I just hadn't remembered it in 20 years. But I, it when it came, I was like, oh, and not only that, but I remember that, you know, that was that day because I think we'd just been to Jared McLaughlin's birthday. You know, they come with all their little side memories.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
In which she doesn't feature, but which, and you're like, how big is this?
Yeah.
This room in my head. So memory is a big part of it because I felt like I was cheated out of the fact that I didn't have as many memories. And then, of course, you have that weird trade-off that you have as you're growing up where you're thinking, well, I do genuinely think that emotionally it was must have been so much harder for a 15-year-old sibling or a 17-year-old sibling in that moment than it was for me, a 5-year-old with a plastic brain who was so complacent about death, or actually just ignorant of the concept of death, that he was walking around telling people, dear mammy died, because you know, and 2 weeks later was going around saying, can mommy not be died, you know, this is almost exact words. And I'd like straighten my back and like, oh, is mommy back from being dead yet? And I'd be saying this to people who were obviously having the most traumatic experience of their lives.
Oh my god.
And there were two younger than me as well who would have been doing similar things. So I'm just like, oh god. And you know, I think I would have been, I probably would have been very anxious about the fact that I didn't know my mum very much, and in fact would meet people who knew my mum by any definition better than I did.
Yeah.
Even people that she'd worked with in schools, you know, if you see someone every single day for 10 years or 5 years, you absolutely know them better. You have probably 1,000 memories of Sheila O'Reilly, and I've got like 5 going on 8.
Yeah.
You know, so that's that rankled with me. There was a woman I met right in the book who's given, I think she was either giving, I was either giving blood or I was having my tetanus shot or a booster shot or something, one of the jabs you get in school. And the woman had worked in the hospital, and so she knew my mum. And so she was telling me these beautiful stories about how, you know, she'd helped this person and she was always in the hospital and she was just such a great person around to be. And she'd always do anything. The typical stuff for my mum, who was a saint. But for whatever reason, I was like, why does this old lady know all this stuff about my mum? And I don't know anything. So I was waiting for my chance to speak. And I knew so little about my mum that it would just come out with stuff that was completely irrelevant to what she had just been saying. So she would say like, and you know, and that was when I really knew that your mum was just one of the greatest people that I've ever met. Pause. And then I'd go, yes, and allergic to bees, of course.
It's all you've got. It's all you've got.
All I've got. She loved coffee, but hated the Australian soap operas. Anyway, it's been lovely having this chat with you. You know, it was like I was a crap talk show host who hadn't done the research about the person. And to some extent, that's been a shame that I've had. Mm. You know, kind of if some weird, it's been processed as sadness, you know, can turn to anger, can turn to other things. And in my case, there was, something like a shame that I didn't know her as well, or that my grief was somehow less worthless. Now, because I was grieving the picture that was on the wall rather than a concrete, coherent person like other people, to the point where people would say, oh, you know, well, you know what your mum was like. And I would want to say, no, I don't, actually. you know, people would say that about like completely random things, almost contradictory things, like, I says, well, she didn't want to take the long way to Enniskillen. You know what your mum's like. I was like, I don't even know what you're saying. And she's like, she doesn't like shortcuts? Or she was a nervous driver? Like, I'm weird. I think it's weird that you think that I would have known that. I was 5. Yeah. Like, what, it's she was hard, coming home it? And telling me how much she hated, like, going a certain way to Enniskillen. Okay. I'm like, oh, my God.
If that was one of your memories, all you had was, well, I do remember her telling me she did not like taking the long way to Enniskillen. You'd be like, wow, she really made sure that was the one thing she makes sure Seamus knows that. Yeah, it's really hard. And I think it's just hard for people to understand, obviously, because, you know, unless you've been through it, that you don't have much. It fades. It's wobbly because you're a kid. I mean, you know, you ask anybody, what do you remember about primary school? And they're struggling. And then I think the other thing I've had to sort of help people with, of like you said, like the letters you've got, like that everything is gold dust because you have so little, it's gold dust. Whereas if you lose a parent, like when you're in your 40s, obviously you've got lots of things. And often people say, oh gosh, you know, there's so much to sort out. There's so many things. And when you're a kid, you're like, I've got this pile. So if you have anything to add to the pile, then I'll probably take it, even if it's a rubbish thing. Like, yeah, the mundanity of things becomes absolute gold dust to you.
Yeah, well, it's, I mean, it's like casting a spell, really.
Yeah,
isn't it?
It is.
It's literally ingredients, putting them down, having it written. I mean, one thing that I didn't find I do as much as people who've lost their parents older is I don't really do checkpointing, like milestoning, where it's like, oh, it'd be great if mummy was here.
I don't
have that, and I haven't had that ever in my life, because there no tradition had ever been established of it.
Yeah.
I mean, it does happen in super, super big picture terms. Like, about 4 months after my son was born, I'd be like, oh, it'd be nice if, actually it would be nice if my mum, you know, was here. Like, even on my wedding day.
Yeah.
I mentioned it in my speech and everything else, but there was no part of me that was, it was almost an active exercise in thoughtfulness for me to presume that, to think about what it would be like if she was there, because so little tradition of that being established was even there, that I didn't think about it at, like, you know, my end of school celebrations or graduation or anything like that. And if I did, it was always very fleeting, in an active thought of consideration, almost like a prayer, almost like being reflecting on this person and their life, but not really as them, as my parent, because
You just have a very, like, different. I totally relate to that. So my husband lost both his dad and his mum, and he lost his mum when he was in his 30s, and when we had kids, there was definitely, he was like, he found that quite painful that she wouldn't know this person. And I was like, oh, it's funny, because I find it sad, obviously, but I've had a long time to know he's never gonna meet my kids. So I found, obviously, because I was 15, so I remember, like, you know, I didn't know my GCSEs, I didn't know my A-levels, like, that was, like, hard at the time, but you just get marker after marker. And then Dawn O'Porter, she lost her mum when she was 6. She said that as well, of like, she doesn't feel like she's grieved, because she felt like it's just something that's always been there. It's not like, oh, I grieved my mum. It's like, that's what it is. That's what my life is. So it's a very different, like you said, we all joined the club. We just all got these slightly different takes on it. And the age you are, of course, it massively affects how you view these things. And I'm the same as you. Like, if I want to get sad about him not meeting my kids, I can, but I have to kind of think about it and be
all
like,
right,
okay,
go.
Yeah,
okay,
yeah, yeah. I have to be like, oh yes, that is a shame. And I definitely got triggered a bit when, like, I'd see grandpas in the playground, and that was, I'd be like, oh right, yeah. And for me, it was like, I had a grandpa I was very close to, so I was like, oh, she's not gonna have that. Like, it was kind of having to adjust in my head of like, right. And I don't know if you have this with your son, like, you know, that he has his mum, and like, that's, he's going to get that. Like,
well, not only that, but I did the awful arithmetic of working out, I don't know what horrible moment of madness this was, but I worked out the date where he would be the same age as I was.
Oh, yeah.
And I just had to sit down after that. That was not a productive day. I was like, why did I do this to myself?
Why? Grief maths. Don't do the grief maths. Yeah.
I mean, Reverend Richard Coles refers to it, was it called Sadmin?
Sadmin, yeah. Yeah,
oh, it's an amazing phrase. Where you think about these kinds of things and you have to put things in their context.
I understand why you did that, though. I definitely understand why you did that, because if I definitely had it when I started getting to the point where I would meet a teenager and they wouldn't look at me like an equal. They'd be like, oh, the nice lady wants to see on the bus. And and I remember being like, oh, and what it is you start seeing yourself in a way that you haven't done. I think that happens with kids. And of course, if your son is heading towards 5, you start being like, oh, that's what I look like. Because when it's you, it's you. You don't stand outside yourself. And I definitely started to see, if I met a teenager, I'd be like, oh, I was a baby. I didn't realize. I thought I was an adult. But now looking at a 15-year-old, I'm like, you're not an adult. You don't know what you're doing. You're a fucking idiot.
Yeah, and it's complicated by the fact that of my 10 brothers and sisters, my son looks really like me. and he looks like, he's small and ginger and pale, and he basically looks very, very, very close to me now. He really took after his mother in the first few years, but now he's kind of lengthened and got a bit of a beak. I have that thing all the time. Like, if he sees a picture of me, there's a picture of me as a child on the book cover, he thinks it looks like him.
Wow.
You know, he has his first thing, though, I've told him it's daddy, but because I've got a little crown on my head, a little sort of paper crown. He refers to it as Daddy the Queen. He does not acknowledge that kings exist because he's...
That's fine. You be a queen.
He's very third wave. But yeah, it is really strange when you see these things through his eyes. And also I feel like I have to gain a little bit more... weirdly, I have to gain more empathy again.
Yeah.
Because I have to go through all this stuff which I have... You know, in the biggest pair of quote marks you've ever seen in your life, dealt with it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I have to then re-explain it. And then sometimes in the course of re-explaining this, like, say, for example, in spending 3 years writing a bloody book about it,
yeah,
you realise, oh, I haven't dealt with any of this. And yeah, I've dealt with some of it really well. And some of it, I've dealt with it the way a 5-year-old deals with things.
Yeah.
And maybe that's why at 10 I had this... what I can only call now a breakdown, but at the time I thought it was just a weird 4 months where I didn't sleep at night.
Yeah.
And then I had another one in college. I had one on a city break to Bilbao. Just little moments, little breaks, and I compare them in the book to sort of controlled explosions.
Yeah.
And kind of tie that into that whole idea that, you know, you're burying something so deep, and you're functioning, and you're doing very well. And not only that, but you're getting praised by people.
Yeah.
Not because you're holding everything in, but because you're just emotional about it enough and
yeah,
whatever. And to some extent, it's just there's no perfect way. And I think I did very, very well out of how my grief was handled. But even in that, which
it's one still of the best grief, case scenarios, it still needs to be handled.
You still find yourself at 23 going, why am I so sad today?
Yeah.
And you're like, God, it's just annoying. But it's also... it's part of the life that we have. It's part of the weird chemistry of our brains. It's part of how our hearts work. And it's really given the alternative. If that is how sad we can get, then just imagine the flights of ecstasy we can achieve as well.
Well, Seamus, on that note, I was going to add it and I thought, no, he's done that writer thing. He said it very well. thank you so much for coming to talk to me about Sheila and your dad. What was your dad's name?
My dad's name is Joe.
Joe,
and he is lovely, and he does sound the way that I made him sound. Can I just say, he read the audiobook, he listened to the audiobook for five hours straight when the day was released.
Wow.
He said, I don't sound like that. Which is my favourite thing to say when I'm doing an impression of my dad, but anyway.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. It was really, really lovely talking to you.
Thank you so much, Carrie. This has been lovely.
You can follow Seamus on Twitter at shockproofbeats. That's shock, proof, and beats, all one word. The book Did You Hear Mammy Died is out, available to buy now. I can't recommend it enough. It's such a beautiful book. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at The Griefcast. The show was recorded remotely from both our living rooms. It was edited by Kate Holland. The music was provided by The Glue Ensemble. And remember, you are not alone.
Catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row, dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.